There is a verse that goes, acceptance of suffering, sitting unmoved, the seeking of nothing, enlightenment proved. This verse sums up what are called Great Master Bodhidharma's four practices. You may be familiar with this, forgive me if you are, but I wanted to talk about that verse as it's connected to the Four Noble Truths and how it is expressive of how we put the Four Noble Truths into practice. So in our series of talks on coming out of the book called Basic Buddhist Concepts by Mizuno, we're at the chapter about the Four Noble Truths. So, and again, my emphasis in this series is talking about how we practice relative to the basic doctrines of Buddhism. So, acceptance of suffering, sitting unmoved, the seeking of nothing, enlightenment proved. This is a pretty good summation of the practice of Zen. Bodhidharma, of course, is the master, the monk, the enlightened teacher who brought the Zen tradition, who is credited with bringing the Zen tradition from India to China. The first noble truth is the truth of the existence of suffering. We talk a lot about suffering. The reason the Buddha talked about suffering, well, he was motivated to do so because he felt sympathy, compassion for beings who he saw were suffering because they're suffering. But he was also wise about the ways of human beings, in the sense that human beings seem to be, kind of from a modern perspective, we seem to be kind of biologically wired to get away from suffering, to move from suffering to pleasure, to find something that's not suffering. It seems to be kind of hardwired into how we are. And I think the Buddha was wise in the sense that he observed that people have a great capacity to deny the existence of suffering. So he was kind of saying, suffering exists, and it's just a characteristic of this human realm that we find ourselves in. It's a characteristic of samsara, the wider, the bigger world of beings and all of that stuff. And so he focuses in on suffering because it's to do that is the way to find peace, to find awakening, to find a deeper truth. When we talk about suffering in Buddhism, it's a translation of a word, dukkha, which can also be translated as unsatisfactoriness. So there's a whole spectrum of experience that we're talking about in terms of suffering, from the intense suffering of war-torn, impoverished regions of the earth that we really don't have much experience of here in the West, to the niggling unsatisfaction of over-brewing your coffee in the morning. Okay, so there's this whole kind of range of suffering, this whole kind of range of unsatisfactoriness that we experience as human beings. Hopefully most of us don't experience that really intense suffering very often, but periodically it does happen to even we privileged Westerners. So the Buddha is saying suffering exists. Bodhidharma is saying, okay, well, suffering exists. What do we do about that? How do we practice with that? How do we deal with suffering? And he's pointing at the mind of acceptance. Again, as kind of biological beings, it's sort of like when I was a kid, you'd go to the tide pools and you could see these kind of anemones and stuff in the tide pools at the Oregon coast. You kind of stick your finger in one and they kind of, you know, completely retreat or whatever, you know, kind of contract to get away from suffering. And in a way, that's our kind of biological response to it. I'm going to get away from this thing. I'm going to get away from whatever it is that's kind of poking me. Bodhidharma is saying, no, there's a better way to deal with this. Acceptance of suffering. We can accept suffering on all of its different ranges throughout its that whole spectrum that I'm talking about. Lately I was kind of noticing something about myself where I have this sort of tension, abdominal tension, where I'm kind of clenched. And it has to do with something going on in my mind. You know, kind of my guts are kind of clenched a fairly good amount of time. And I noticed that it's connected to a thing in my mind where, because of past conditioning, my mind is always kind of in action, trying to figure out what's going on in terms of the social situation, how do I keep from making people mad and all this stuff. And so there's this kind of constant activity which kind of started when I was a kid, but kind of is perpetuated into now, where I'm just kind of constantly on hyper alert in a certain way. And it's based in a misunderstanding of present circumstances, but it's there. So as I'm sitting, as I'm doing my meditation practice, I'm looking at that and I'm trying to, when I notice that tension come up, I'm trying to sit still in that tension and just accept it. And by sitting still and accepting it and kind of working with my mind to sort of say, okay, there I am, I'm all active in my mind, I'm spinning in my mind, I'm going to let that go and I'm going to sit still in a deeper place and relax to the extent that I can my abdomen. And that awareness, that process, is what I'm talking about accepting suffering. So there's just a subtle kind of tension and physical tension that I'm looking at in my mind. And I'm just working on just accepting that it's there, sitting still in it, accepting that it's there. We accept suffering not as a passive reaction to it, but as the first step, as the first kind of response to suffering, so that we can then see more clearly what's going on, accept the situation, and find a way to respond to it positively. One of the things that you learn as you practice Buddhism, in contrast to just reading the ideas on paper, is that it really is designed for a living process, a living person in process. So the acceptance of suffering, again, is not just a passive action. It's part of our active life. It's part of our active response to whatever arises in our mind, whatever arises in our experience. So we start with acceptance. One of the things about the Four Noble Truths is they're a whole package. We can't really take one of them without all four of them. They're a whole package. And Bodhidharma's four practices are also a whole package. The second noble truth is the cause of suffering. The cause of suffering is grasping. And And that has all manner, again, of different aspects to it. Sometimes our grasping takes the form of actual grasping. Sometimes our grasping takes the form of pushing away. Sometimes our grasping takes the form of, this is not really how things are. Things are not as they are. Things are different. I'm going to convince myself that things are different than they are. And this grasping is not just simple desire like hunger or something like that that arises, but there's a deeper quality to it that impels us in a very energetic way to cling to things which are not real. Which we're actually not able to cling to. So the cause of suffering is grasping. The third of Bodhidharma's practices, seeking of nothing. We practice the seeking of nothing when we recognize when grasping is arising, when we recognize that that we're doing the thing which causes us to suffer. Seeking of nothing is, has all manner of different facets, but predominantly it is an attitude of mind. It is the attitude of mind which says, I can be content with whatever there is here. It's the attitude of mind that is connected to the acceptance of suffering. In one sense, we resist acceptance of suffering because we think that by accepting suffering, we are getting less than we ought to get. We're going to be stuck with something that isn't good enough, that we are, in some sense, deficient in our life. By practicing seeking of nothing, we're effectively saying, I have enough, I am sufficient. The third noble truth is that enlightenment exists. Enlightenment exists. There is a cessation of suffering. That is, and again, all these things need to be taken. I'm going to talk about them in a kind of linear way, but all of these things need to be taken as a package. The Buddha kind of firmly makes this statement. The cessation of suffering exists. Enlightenment exists. Awakening exists. And you all, we all, can find that for ourselves. And when we act on the teaching of the Buddha, when we act according to practice, we are giving expression to the existence of enlightenment. We may not feel like that, but that is in fact what we're doing. There's a kind of optical illusion which you might have encountered, where you see just a simple black and white picture where you might see two black faces looking at one another, and they're symmetrical. Just the outline of two faces looking at one another. And you look at that picture, and that's what you see. But after a while of looking at it, and in some sense, after a while looking at it and partly forgetting that what you're seeing is two faces looking at each other, you eventually see that there's a goblet in between the two, in the white space. Because our orientation towards suffering is that we want to get away from it. We think that this teaching that the Buddha has that says there's a cessation of suffering means that our suffering, that suffering will go away. And to a certain extent, that does happen. But there is still the first noble truth, which is that suffering just exists. In a way, the awakening of the Buddha, what the awakening of the Buddha is talking about, is learning how to see that goblet in that optical illusion. And see that that goblet is deeply significant. When we put the teachings of the Buddha into practice, we come to more deeply understand, more deeply see that that goblet exists. And that doesn't actually deny the existence of the two black faces, the existence of suffering. But there is something else that is real and significant. Our grasping, in a way, is the effort to make those two faces into the reality of life. But the truth of the matter is, they're not. We're, in a sense, making a mistake because we fail to see that other element of the picture. We fail to see Buddha nature, Buddha mind. So part of the practice, part of our practice, part of our training is letting go of our old perspective and stepping into a new perspective about life. It's a conversion of view. It's a conversion of perspective. And I think that's really important to recognize, both for our mature understanding of what to expect as we practice, but also to realize that the practice of just sitting still, sitting unmoved, letting go of everything, is aimed at that awakening of a new perspective, that awakening of the ability to see beyond the surface of things, to be able to see that other picture in there. Okay. The fourth noble truth, again, part of the four noble truths, is the Eightfold Path. And those are eight aspects of what to do in order to continue on the path of awakening. Again, the Buddha Dharma is designed for living human beings who exist in time and who have the world to deal with. And in that sense, is quite practical. The Eightfold Path gives us the eight aspects of our path through life as we encounter it. In a way, I'll talk about the Eightfold Path in greater detail the next time we meet, or the next time I record a talk. But in a way, that Eightfold Path is pointing at that practice of Bodhidharma, actually all the practices of Bodhidharma, sitting unmoved. That is right meditation. Sitting unmoved, in a way, I suppose I should be honest. I don't really know what sitting unmoved means. Because my meditation is always kind of letting go of something and coming back to sitting still. In a way, though, that sitting unmoved is pointing at that same idea of the optical illusion. It's recognizing that the real thing in me is that background which just sits still, and that everything else, all of time, all of experience that goes by, is what impermanence is. And that is the unreal thing. Sitting unmoved is just returning to that place inside of us that is unmoved. And as we continue to come back to that place, we recognize that it is always sitting unmoved. And that is really who we are. That is really where we exist. That is the kind of, you know, the real part of us. Again, Buddha nature exists. Enlightenment exists. And so, in a sense, we follow the Buddha's path, we follow the path of training, and it goes along its twisty little way, and we're headed to into this place we call enlightenment. And so we think of the path of Buddhism as a way toward a goal. And in a certain respect, there's a true element to that. But there's also this other element to it, which is that the path is just the path to this moment right here, right now. The path is to this mind and body right here, right now. And goes no further than that. It is awakening to the real life that is present right now. And so, in a way, by putting the Buddha's teachings into practice, we are literally proving enlightenment to be true right now in this very body and mind. And while that may, depending on the state of your suffering or the state of your experience, that may not seem terribly significant, but as we go along, there is a deep kind of comfort in that, even when we don't see it. As Dogen says, right where we are right now, our feet are firmly planted on the way. All we have to do is just continue to return to practice right here where we are. He said, our eventual success is built upon 1,000 failures. And in a way, that eventual success is not really different from those 1,000 failures. It's just that eventually we come to recognize what the Buddhas and ancestors, what Dogen taught, is true. And we begin to know that in our blood and bones. We know that kind of to the root of our being. And this kind of knowledge is not really something that is mine to possess. It's more like kind of the truth of the wood table. It's just an aspect of the wood table is solid in its own particular way, and it doesn't really need to know that. It just is that thing. And as we go along, we recognize the truth of our being is this kind of deeper reality. So, acceptance of suffering, weak. Turn to where we are, we just accept what there is. Sitting unmoved, we just sit still, content with what there is. Seeking of nothing, oh, there I go again, looking into the unreality of things, bring myself back to sitting still. Enlightenment proved, oh, okay, in the festival of the Buddha's enlightenment this last weekend, he says, although we all possess wisdom as unfathomable as the sea, something like this, and the pure Dharma body, we obscure we obscure these things with by following after greed, hate, and delusion. Enlightenment proved, I do have wisdom as unfathomable as the ocean. I do have the pure Dharma body. How can I better learn how to act in accord with that? How can I better learn how to let go of greed, hate, and delusion? It's a continuous cycle. It's all one thing. The Eightfold Path is symbolized by an eight-spoked wheel. The wheel only works as a wheel when it has all eight factors in it. And that wheel is what kind of is the mechanism that gets the cart of our life down the road. The Four Noble Truths are a wheel of their own, and they need to work together as we kind of move along and inform each other. You can't really take one and understand it without the others. Okay. Any questions or thoughts? Yes.
Have you ever... I remember reading years ago that the root of the word dukkha also had something to do with a cart with a wobbly wheel. And it was like, initially it might be kind of fun, but after a while it gets really, really annoying. And it just occurred to me that if one of the spokes on the Eightfold Path, let's say you try your best to live by seven of them, but you leave out the eighth, whichever one it happens to be,
yeah,
it's going to end up causing suffering because you've got your out of round wheel. It just like popped into my head.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. I think that rings a bell, but I can't remember the exact thing there. It does remind me of a story from the past lives of the Buddha, the story of the wheelwright. And so there's this king, and he's getting ready for a big competition with chariot races. And he goes to his wheelwright, and he wants him to make new wheels for his chariot, so he'll have the best advantage. And the wheelwright's a master wheelwright. And so he says, okay, well, this project is coming up, and could you do this? And the wheelwright says, sure. So he gets to work on the wheels, and he's working on one wheel, which takes him, you know, takes him 6 or 8 months to do this one wheel. And the king comes to him and says, oh, we've changed the date. I think we've changed the date of the chariot races, and it's 6 months earlier. What can you do? And wheelwright says, okay, I've got one wheel done, but we should be able to get something together for you. So he spends, a week or whatever, and please forgive me, I'm sure I mangled the details of this story, but the essence of it will come through. So he spends a week or whatever making the second wheel, and he puts the, they put the chariot together, and I think the way the story goes is the king goes out and they have the chariot races and he wins and all that stuff, and then he kind of comes back and he says, well, that worked out really well. What's the difference between the two wheels? And the wheelwright says, okay, well, I'll show you. And they take the wheels off, and he takes the wheel that he took 6 months to build, or nearly 6 months to build, and they roll it across the field, up this field. And the wheel rolls you know, continuously across this field, straight, true, comes to a halt, stops standing up, and just stands there. They take the second wheel and roll it across the field, and it does pretty good. It rolls straight, doesn't go quite as far as the first wheel, and then turns around and falls to the ground. And so the message of the story is that, although slightly different than what you're talking about, but I'll fill it in here in just a second. The message of the story is that by our careful effort in training, whatever effort we can put into our training in terms of understanding what we're doing, all the detail that we can bring to training will be quite beneficial, will help in the long run in terms of making that quality wheel. It is also possible, in one sense, to go quite quickly and awaken to the truth and not have that subtlety of detail in our particular life. So there's a metaphorical meaning there in terms of training and practice. But the thing of it is, there's merit in both wheels. Each one has their merit, and they both, and the two wheels in combination kind of got the job done. Okay. So the point of this is that in terms of the Eightfold Path and the wheel analogy, is that even if one of the spokes is missing and your wheel is kind of wobbly a little bit, if you're going forward with that practice, then there is merit, and the wheel is still a kind of effective wheel. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And Reverend Master Ji used to say that in the East, monks, you know, if somebody who was, say, a prostitute would come to a monk and say, I'd like to take the precepts. So they'd say, okay, we'll give you the four precepts, you know, don't lie, don't steal, don't indulge in intoxicants, and don't speak against others or whatever it was, don't kill. That was the fourth one. But we won't give you the precept about misusing sexuality at this point. And so you put those four precepts into practice, and when you're able to kind of get to the point where you can put the practice against misusing sexuality into practice, then we'll give you that fifth precept. And the practicality of the teaching is that by putting what you can into practice, then you will kind of create the merit to be able to put it, the whole thing, into practice. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
I was just going to bring that up.
Yeah. Although your point about suffering and being like that, a kind of wobbly wheel that eventually creates more suffering, is also true. One of the things that we do, and again, this is because of our mistaken orientation toward existence or toward our experience, because we want to get away from suffering, we tend to do things which we think will get us away from suffering. So, and what we end up doing is actually heading in the direction of more suffering. So because we're pushing away and not accepting the reality of suffering, we're headed in a direction which creates more suffering. We find sexual release to be pleasurable, and not realizing that that's a transient experience, and the more you grasp after it, the more it creates problems for you. We pursue that, you know, kind of sexual pleasure or whatever, and not recognizing that what we're really trying to do is get away from the experience of the painful experience of wanting something that we can't have. So by trying to get away from that experience, we try to fulfill it by filling it up with further experiences. But in fact, what we need to do is just sit still and let go of the desire to, you know, kind of satisfy that thing in an inappropriate way. Does that make sense? Okay, anything else? Okay, well, thank you very much.